Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris and I'd like to thank you all for tuning in for another episode of My Classic Album. Today we're going to be looking at Hotter Than Hell by Kiss, their second album back in 1974. My special guest who's chosen that today is the singer of a fantastic band, Beth Blade and the Beautiful Disasters. Beth Blade herself will be joining me to chat about an album that arguably is one of the most underappreciated that we've done so far on My Classic Album. In some ways, it's not a classic album in terms of critical reviews or album sales, but I'm sure that hard rock fans and Kiss fans in general would agree that Hotter Than Hell is certainly a highlight of their back catalogue, and it was a real fun conversation chatting to a fellow Kiss fan about what is truly a classic album. So that's coming up in just a little bit. I'm also going to take a few moments to talk about my experience of seeing Iron Maiden at the Metro Radio Arena. If you haven't had a chance to see Iron Maiden before and they're the sort of band that you're into, I couldn't recommend it more. And I'll get into that in just a little bit. What's kind of cool is that this episode of My Classic Album, we're on episode 11 so far, and we've covered all sorts of albums from different genres, but I think that you could pretty firmly put most, if not all of them, into the rock category and all the various kind of sub-genres within that. But I think this one's probably the closest to what I listen to on a daily basis. I'm a huge fan of Kiss, I'm a huge fan of Iron Maiden, so this episode will give you a really good idea of the sort of stuff that I tend to reach for on the iPod, or you get that album out and have a listen. So yeah, it's a really good one for me, really looking forward to getting stuck in. But I just wanted to take a minute to go into what's kind of coming up over the next few months on My Classic Album. We've covered some awesome albums so far, and there's some really cool ones to come, and again, just really, I think, a pretty cool mix of albums over the next few months. So anyone who is a fan of My Classic Album on Facebook, on Twitter, or on Instagram, and I'll give you the details for that at some point in the show, those of you that keep updated on the show there will know already that we've got the next 4 months of My Classic Album planned. So next month's episode of My Classic Album for July, we'll be looking at Carole King's Tapestry. So anyone who's listening in the spring will know that we looked at Joni Mitchell's album Blue, and we looked at James Taylor's Sweet Baby James. So that's all very much in this kind of singer-songwritery hub of California in the 1970s, and Carole King just slots right into that. So Ashton Lane's Esther O'Connor. Ashton Lane are an awesome country band from Scotland, and Esther sat down with me and we chatted all about Tapestry a couple of months ago now. But that'll be July's episode of My Classic Album, and I really enjoyed chatting to Esther, as I do all the guests, to be perfectly honest. So that's coming up in July. August will be a year of the podcast, which is really special. I didn't particularly think that far ahead when I started it. I didn't know if it's something that would go on more than a couple of episodes as an experiment. But August's episode is going to be a little different. So I reached out on Facebook a few weeks ago as to kind of special episodes of My Classic Album that we might want to do. And one of the ideas I'd mentioned was to do, instead of an episode about an album, to do an episode about a back catalogue of albums, like a band that has a really kind of defined back catalogue. And there was a really strong response to that. So episode 2 of My Classic Album, my special guest was Ian Matthews, who's a good friend of mine, and we talked about OK Computer by Radiohead. Ian and I, the reason we're such good friends, or one of the reasons, is that we're both huge Queen fans. And I thought, who better to sit and talk about Queen with for an extended period of time than Ian? So August's edition of My Classic Album, celebrating a year of the podcast, will be looking at the back catalogue of Queen, a special My Classic discography from Queen's self-titled debut album right through to Made in Heaven. We might even touch on some of the Queen and Paul Rodgers collaborations, perhaps even some solo stuff. I haven't actually recorded the conversation yet, so it's difficult to know kind of where that'll go. But needless to say, if you are a fan of Queen's kind of singles, but you want to get more into the album side of things, we'll be talking about kind of standout tracks, kind of where the band were at that time, might even delve into some solo stuff, all sorts of things. I haven't actually recorded it yet, so we'll see kind of how that evolves as me and Ian chat. But needless to say, August's edition will be a My Classic discography, and we'll be looking at Queen. September, I'm very excited about September's episode because I had so much fun recording it. I was chatting with a fantastic blues singer, Big Boy Bloater, who, if you have had the chance to pick up his album, Luxury Hobo, or any of the stuff, he previously played guitar for Imelda May. He's a very talented bloke, and he's a lot of fun. And he chose Blondie's Parallel Lines. So again, talking about bands where you like their singles and how we listen to albums, Blondie are a band where I kind of viewed them as a singles band. I enjoy their singles. And so he picked Parallel Lines, and I was very interested. And it's a great album. Really is a classic album. And we had a really fun chat about it. It was awesome. So that's coming in September. And then October, we're doing something similar to what we did in February with Rumours. So Bat Out of Hell will be 40 years old in October. Now, anyone who listens to the podcast will know that Bat Out of Hell is my favourite album of all time. And that's what we'll be talking about in October. And the special guest, for lack of a better term, will be me. And I haven't quite worked out who will be asking me the questions. I'm still trying to work that out. But October's episode of My Classic Album will celebrate 40 years of Bat Out of Hell. And that'll give me an opportunity to kind of wax lyrical about my favourite album of all time. So that's kind of what's coming up for the next few months. So that's going to keep us very busy. But before we get into all that, let's talk about Iron Maiden. So I saw Iron Maiden at the Metro Radio Arena in May. They have just completed a pretty big UK tour with Shinedown supporting. And I'd saw Iron Maiden 6 years ago now. They did the Final Frontier tour and I really enjoyed it. But my main criticism was I felt the set list was maybe a little too heavy of the more recent stuff and I wanted to hear more classics. Even though it was an amazing show and I don't think you can ever fault the musicianship of Iron Maiden. But that was kind of my feelings coming out of it in 2011. So when the tour was announced, I was interested to go. But kind of with a lot of what's happening at the moment, you know, I'm going to be a dad in July. We're kind of trying to save money. I thought to myself, can I justify paying £65 for a ticket to see Iron Maiden? And so I kind of thought, no, I'm not going to go. And it's almost like the universe was telling me that I had to go because I kept getting all sorts of weird and wonderful signs that I should be going to see them. For example, people having spare tickets, people suddenly realising they couldn't go. My social media pages, Facebook particularly, was just full of Iron Maiden related stuff, not even necessarily related to the tour. And it just got to a point where I thought, it's a shame I'm not going. I wish I was going. And on the day of the gig, I got a phone call again from Ian Matthews, who we've just been talking about. And Ian was going to Iron Maiden. His friend that he was going with was going too, but his son couldn't make it. His son was unwell. And so there was a spare ticket. And I just thought, it's the day of the gig. I've been offered a spare ticket about 10 times. I'm going to go. So my wife actually bought me it as an early birthday present. My birthday is on June the 12th. And she said, tell you what, early birthday present, go. You'll really enjoy it. So we went along. We didn't catch Shinedown. I did see them last year, actually, on the Carnival of Madness tour. So Carnival of Madness is like a tour that they do around America. But they did it in the UK last year, and Blackstone Cherry headlined, and Shinedown were just below them. And they were a great band. Anyone who watches WWE will probably know them most. Their song, Enemies, is the current theme for Monday Night Raw. But no, they're a great band. And I think that it seemed like an odd fit with Iron Maiden, and I think they've kind of said this themselves, that Iron Maiden fans are notoriously hard on support acts, but it sounds like they went down really well. We kind of, because we'd got there a little later and we decided just to have a drink in the foyer and all that sort of thing, you could hear Shinedown on and they sounded good, just as they had when I saw them in Leeds last year. But I don't think the other guys were interested in seeing Shinedown. But I'd be interested in people's thoughts if anyone was at Newcastle or any date on the tour, what their thoughts were on Shinedown, because I certainly enjoyed them when I saw them last year. So Iron Maiden came on, and I mean, they always just put on an awesome show, don't they? That's the thing. Iron Maiden just always put on this absolutely crazy, phenomenal show. And Bruce Dickinson just runs around like a madman. And I think the thing is, what you forget sometimes, I thought his voice held out really well. If anything, stronger than when I saw them 5-6 years ago. You almost forgot that this guy had throat cancer, you know? For those who don't know, Bruce Dickinson had throat cancer. He was diagnosed 2 years ago, shortly before the album came out, maybe slightly after. So the tour was postponed. And, you know, obviously everything's fine and he's got the all clear. And he just sounded awesome. He sounded phenomenal. The band were in absolute top form. And I think what was cool is the new album, The Book of Souls, it's a great album. I hadn't heard much of it before the gig. What I had heard, I'd enjoyed. But I didn't feel like they lent on it too much. Like, they did maybe 5 or 6 songs from Book of Souls. And then there was a really kind of good mix of, like, stuff from the 80s, from the 90s, since their reunion in 2000. Like, all sorts of a real good spread of their back catalogue. So, you know, stuff from Brave New World, stuff from Number of the Beast, stuff from Fear of the Dark. It was a really good, that kind of criticism that I had was unwarranted this time, because I felt that they really kind of went for it and did a bit for everyone, you know? And for me, you know, as long as they do Number of the Beast and The Trooper, I'm always happy, because they're, for me, my two favourite Maiden songs. The only tiny criticism that I could say, bearing in mind that this comes from someone who loves the album Number of the Beast, is that I just wish that they would do Run to the Hills live. You know, I've seen them twice. I've unfortunately not been able to hear them perform Run to the Hills live. And it's just an awesome, awesome track. And hopefully one day I'll get to see that. I'm sure they're sick of playing it. I'm sure that's why they don't play it. But it's just an amazing song. They also couldn't play Hallowed Be Thy Name. There's some kind of legal dispute going on there. And that was disappointing. But again, you can kind of understand if there's kind of question marks over the legalities of the song. Maybe it makes sense to pull it from the set list. I don't know. But I'd say other than those two songs, they pretty much nailed the set list for me. I thought it was absolutely awesome. And it must be hard for a band like Iron Maiden, who've been around for so long, to be able to juggle all these different eras of their back catalogue and land on a set list that works. So absolute thumbs up to Iron Maiden. It was a phenomenal show. And, you know, don't leave it so long next time before you come back to Newcastle, would be my advice. It was just an awesome show. You could tell everyone was having a really good time. You could tell the band were having a good time. And yeah, I believe they're touring America now. I think they're now, the Book of Souls tour is going into America. So if you're listening in the States, and I know that we do have a few American listeners, and you're on the fence about Iron Maiden, check them out. Just check them out. They were absolutely phenomenal. So yeah, I think that's enough from me. I think the best thing we can do is get started. So my special guest for this month is Beth Blade, and she has chosen Kisses Hotter Than Hell as her classic album. But before we get chatting to Beth, let's just have a little look, a bit of a fact burst. Here's what you need to know about Hotter Than Hell. Released on October 22nd, 1974, Hotter Than Hell is the second album from American hard rock band Kiss. The album was recorded throughout August 1974 to capitalise on the momentum from their debut album that was released earlier that year. The band relocated from New York to LA to record the album, giving them the opportunity to reunite with producers Kenny Kerner and Richie Wise, who had worked with the band on their first album. In spite of going through financial woes at the time, the band's label Casablanca Records handled the album's release. Life in LA was tough on all members of the band, but the Hotter Than Hell album sessions gave birth to some of the most lauded songs in Kiss's back catalogue. Tracks including Parasite, Let Me Go Rock and Roll, and the title track Hotter Than Hell have since become staples of their live shows over the years. Sadly, with Casablanca on the verge of collapse, the album was promoted poorly, and as a result sales suffered due to a lack of a hit single. Let Me Go Rock and Roll, the only single released from the album, stalled in the singles charts, but the track was nonetheless a strong indicator for the kind of sound that Kiss would move towards in the near future. Sales were slow for Hotter Than Hell itself, but after Kiss hit mainstream success with the release of Alive in 1975, the album gained some momentum. Hotter Than Hell managed to crack the top 100 on the Billboard charts in the US, and by 1977, it had certified gold in both the US and Canada as a result of new Kiss fans revisiting the back catalogue. In spite of its slow sales at the time, Hotter Than Hell has grown in esteem with Kiss fans, who appreciate the darker, lyrical themes present on the album. This love from fans and critics alike led Rolling Stone magazine to name Hotter Than Hell on its list of 10 greatest Kiss albums in 2014. So that's just the beginning of what you need to know about Hotter Than Hell. And I have here with me my very special guest who chose Hotter Than Hell for my classic album. This is Beth Blade. How's it going?
Hello, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Absolutely fantastic. And as I was just saying to you just before we got started, I'm really excited that we're finally covering a Kiss album. Why have you chosen Hotter Than Hell as your classic album?
Well, for a start, it's ludicrous that nobody's chosen a Kiss album for you before. It's just silly. And just every song on this album is solid. And, you know, there's some great songwriting. I never skip a track on this album.
So, when we were discussing that we were going to talk on my classic album, we discussed a few Kiss albums that could have been the focus of this episode. So you talked about albums like Rock and Roll Over, Revenge and Creatures of the Night. What made you settle on Hotter Than Hell in particular over those other albums?
Again, so like, you know, Revenge is a really critically acclaimed Kiss album. It had Bob Ezrin producing it, and Creatures of the Night is a very different album to Kiss in terms of production and sound and direction. You know, it was before they did The Elder. So it was a very heavy album. And I chose Hotter Than Hell, the songwriting in particular. So as a musician, songwriting is really important to me. And I think that people should work really hard at it. All of these songs have really interesting musical ideas and also lyrical ideas. And not a lot of people think of Kiss as brilliant musicians. They think of them as a gimmick band. So I chose this album because I think it's really musically strong, and the songwriting in particular.
Cool. So it's funny you're touching on kind of this perception of Kiss. So as a self-confessed member of the Kiss Army, I'm aware that they often get like a really bad rap. They're not always given their due. And interestingly, this is the first album that we've covered on the podcast that wasn't included in Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Albums of All Time. But ironically, it's one of my favourite albums that we've covered. So you've started touching it already. Why do you think Kiss have been so underestimated by people over the years?
People look at the makeup and they don't give them a chance. I mean, there's times personally where I have had friends who have gone, oh God, Kiss, they're such a gimmick band. I don't like that stuff. It's too campy for me. And then I'll put a record on and they're like, this is really good. Who's this? And I'm like, well, it's Kiss. So because of their reputation of being, you know, marketing, merchandising, the image, everything that goes with that, people actually don't appreciate the fact that the reason why Kiss are such a big band is that their songs are really catchy, really well formed, and just incredible. And considering that, you know, every single member of Kiss, like the Beatles, wrote songs and sang, and that doesn't happen in a lot of bands. It's not a common thing. You know, the lead guitarist plays lead guitar, the singer sings and writes the lyrics, and that's it. But people don't get the opportunity to see that. They get frightened off by the image. You know, and it's just silly. I think I love Kiss's image. I love the makeup. It makes them different from everybody else. You can only go so far on fireworks and stuff like that, you know, and makeup. You have to have good songs. And they get a bad rap all the time, and they really don't deserve it.
And it's interesting you talk about the Beatles, because that kind of brings me on to my next point. I think that Kiss are criminally underrated. And both Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley have spoken about their love and inspiration from the Beatles. And I really believe that you can kind of see that in the way the band present themselves. As you say, kind of the fact that everybody's involved in the songwriting process, everybody's singing songs, even the fact that there's kind of the movies and the merchandise, even that kind of character idea that everyone's kind of got a favourite Kiss member, everyone had a favourite Beatle, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have that whole thing of they all dyed their hair jet black and then they started wearing the makeup, so they were different but same at the same time. And, you know, Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley, they saw Alice Cooper and were like, well, why don't we take the Beatles, you know, groundwork, but instead of having the four Beatles on stage, we want four Alice Coopers on stage. And it's funny, earlier you were just saying about the fact that this album isn't in the Rolling Stone top 500 albums. It's just nuts to me that it's not. And that's, you know, journalism is very necessary, but Rolling Stone have always hated Kiss, so I imagine that's probably why they haven't been included in it.
And it's funny, I mean obviously I love Kiss, one of my favorite bands being Queen, and throughout Queen's career Rolling Stone really gave Queen a hard time as well. So it's interesting that as much as many of the albums that we cover are really loved by Rolling Stone, they were kind of guilty of missing out really important and really well-loved bands and singers in their kind of reviews and their musical taste, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, journalism doesn't reflect what the masses think. This is the thing nowadays about people like, you know, Justin Bieber and all that kind of thing. But what you have to think about it as a music fan is that if something is that popular, there's a reason why.
So I read a really interesting article from a blog called Wobble House about Kiss in general, but they're particularly in the early days, that floated the idea that Kiss were essentially like an early form of punk. So that might sound a bit odd, but here's a quote just to kind of give you a flavour of that. It said, "Suspend your disbelief. The proof is in the pudding. Like the punks and every movement in rock, Kiss created their own thing, their own look and their own sound. Both gravitated to shock value, and like the punks, Kiss had zero shame, eventually drawing you in with their sheer will, devotion and spectacle. This idea kind of places Kiss in a more radical position than some music critics, like Rolling Stone we've been talking about, would have you believe."
That's a brilliant quote. I very much like that quote. And it's true, they created something that was entirely unique at that time. You know, it's never going to be able to be done again. They were in the right place at the right time. And it shocked people. You know, you had people protesting at the concert, saying they were Satanists. But with Kiss, they kind of had this vision in their head and they just went for it, and they didn't change it. They wouldn't change who they were for anybody. Paul Stanley is, you know, an advocate of if you work hard enough, you can do something. And like on posters in New York, Kiss were being referred to as heavy metal because they played louder than any of the other bands, because they just wanted the whole experience to be so in your face. And from that point of view, it is very punk, and it's that I'm going to do this no matter what you tell me. They're actually really very anti-establishment. They're so original and individual that for me, they are apart from every other band that has existed. They don't get enough credit for creating something, because they did. They created something entirely unique.
So Hotter Than Hell, if we get onto the album specifically, was recorded in August 1974.
Yeah.
as a quick follow-up to capitalise on Kiss's self-titled debut. So where were Kiss at this early stage in their career?
They were, you know, they'd just been touring the first album non-stop for about 18 months. And first album only sold, I think it was 150,000 copies. Now, at that time, that was seen as a failure. Now, that would be an incredible feat, just the difference in time. So they wanted to get them straight back in the studio, do a follow-up and hope that it would sell better. But they went to Los Angeles, and they were all from New York. So that already is such a big step away from their first album that it put them in a entirely different situation. Hotter Than Hell is the follow-up album, and they've got to write new songs from scratch in a short amount of time. That's terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's funny when you're talking about that kind of move between New York and California, and they've all gone on record as saying famously that they didn't like relocating to record the album. Kiss's label Casablanca were in fear of going out of business. Even Paul Stanley's guitar was stolen on their first day in LA. So Peter Criss said this of their time in California: "There were a lot of bad vibes. We weren't used to California. We were New Yorkers. We were like, hey, fuck you, I'll kick your ass. We weren't used to this California scene." So do you agree that if Kiss were feeling like uncertain or unhappy in their current position, that this could have been reflected in the music they recorded?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Hotter Than Hell is a really sonically different album to the rest of all of Kiss's albums. And you can tell in the songs that, not that they were unhappy, but everything was just a little darker. You have songs like Parasite and Strange Ways and Watching You, and they're all really quite riff-laden and heavy.
As we've been discussing, they've relocated to work with their producers Kenny Koerner and Richie Wise, who'd worked with Kiss on their first album. And the big talking point, which you've began to touch on, is that Hotter Than Hell, in terms of its production and its kind of themes lyrically, is a lot darker than a lot of other Kiss albums. So, you know, songs like Going Blind and Got to Choose have a far darker lyrical content than, say, a song like Firehouse. So how does that dark nature contrast with kind of future albums that Kiss would go on to release?
Well, see, this is the thing. So they never did it again until they got to Creatures in the Night. Obviously, what happened with Kiss is that they did Kiss, Hotter Than Hell, Dressed to Kill, and they were literally going to be dropped from their label. And then they released Alive, and it all kicked off. And then they released Destroyer, which was polished and perfect with Bob Ezrin. And then they kind of stuck with that for a long time. So I think they may be kind of a little bit scared to do something different. And then obviously they got to Creatures of the Night, where they'd lost Peter Criss and Ace Frehley. And then they did something different again, because they had to. They had to change. So it really is like a one-off in their early work. And I really like the fact that it's the only one.
So a lot has been said about the production on this album, as we've touched on, with both producers Koerner and Wise, as well as Paul Stanley, believing it could have been better. So in biography Kiss Behind the Mask, Paul said, "We hope to remedy the sonic deficiencies we found in the first album. We were never as rock and rolly or good timey as we sounded on that album. We were much heavier live. So for the subsequent album, Hotter Than Hell, we tried to capture sonically how we sounded live. Unfortunately, the people we were working with might not have been the right people to be doing it with." Do you think, bearing in mind everything that we've been saying, do you think that's a bit of a disservice to this album?
Yeah, I mean, I like how the album sounds. It's so distorted and crackly, and it gives it character. If it was like the debut Kiss, it wouldn't have had that darkness to it. But I do understand that if you hear Kiss play Watching You live, it's sonically so much better than on the record.
So we've talked a bit about perceived problems with the album, but I think Time, as you agree, surely, has been very kind to it. So one thing that Rolling Stone has said about it ranked it as the fifth greatest Kiss album of all time in 1997. And in their original review back in the 70s, they said that the band sounded tighter and more lethal than they had in the past. I almost feel like it's the sound of a band that are ready to break out, which they do that following year when Alive's released.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like they released Kiss and it didn't do very well. And then they released this album. They ended up really big in Japan and people loved that they had Japanese artwork and that kind of kabuki makeup almost. And it's just one of those albums. It's a proper rock and roll album. And it's just balls to the wall, good songs, played with tenacity and hunger. And you can hear that. You can really hear that.
So before we delve in and go track by track, I've got to talk about the album cover for a minute. So you've already touched on the kind of relationship with the Japanese fans. This cover is arguably one of the most iconic in a collection of albums with amazing artwork, thanks to this kind of Japanese theme of the album. The real story, however, seems to be about the photo shoot for the album, that by kind of some accounts essentially came some kind of drunken craziness. Like, have you heard a lot about this, or...?
Ever so slightly legendary. The photo shoot was essentially, I think it was done at the Riley Stages in Hollywood, I think, off the top of my head. The front and the back cover were shot on the same day. And it's one of the rare times where Paul Stanley says he's ever got absolutely smashed to the point where that they had to lock him in the car because they just didn't know what else to do with him. But another interesting fact is before one of the sessions that they did, Chris Reilly had a car accident while driving drunk. And he crashed and he cut his head. So most of his shots are in profile. And the ones that are on front are actually Photoshopped, like early versions of Photoshop. They filled in the gaps and made it look like he had full makeup. So as much as they Kiss, I would say Gene and Paul weren't partiers. It's, you know what, we're going to let loose for this. Let's have some fun. And the resulting images are quite bizarre.
Absolutely. I mean, Peter Criss, I was reading about it, and he probably sums up the vibe of the photo shoot best. So he said, "It was a wild photo session for the back cover. I was sitting in the armchair there with this broad giving me head with this mask on. It was really fucking wild. Paul was in bed with a bunch of broads and me in a robe over this big knight's table's chair. The photographer got us all drunk. That was the idea. He got us all loaded. Everyone was drunk except Gene, but Gene had to be drunk on the whole room being drunk. Even the models and the people in the room were drunk. No one was sober. But Gene, but he had to be intoxicated from just the intoxication of the whole vibe."
Very famous teetotaler, but even when he tells stories about that party, he's just like, it was absolutely crazy. And there were women there, so he was probably very happy about that.
Absolutely. So now seems a good time as any to go track by track. So we'll start with the first track on the album, of course, which is Got to Choose. So this is one of three songs on the album written and sung by Paul Stanley. The song is essentially about a guy whose girlfriend cheats on him and he's got to choose between them. So how does this song kick off the album for you?
It's perfect. That opening riff, the boom, 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 is classic. And then the kick drum comes in. And the funny thing about that is that when you're playing songs, you quickly realise that, you know, people take bits and pieces from songs. Whereas Paul Stanley himself, he says that... the riff is from Wilson Pickett, 99 and a half won't do. That riff is actually the riff that's in Stairway to Heaven, but it's backwards. So he's probably like flipped it on its head. As for the lyrical content, obviously, you know, his woman has cheated on him and he's telling her she's got to choose between, and the woo woo woos, that's what makes it so catchy. You've got the story happening, and then the melody draws you in even further. It's a fantastic song. It's actually one of my favourite Kiss songs of all time. And acoustic, it's just out of this world.
And it's funny when you're talking about the woo woo woo, because that's kind of... Well, obviously, I've listened to the album a few times before we chatted, just to kind of get reacquainted with it. And it is the one that's stuck in my head, probably out of all of them. I can see why Paul loves it. He's called it one of his favourite songs. And it is, as I say, one of the songs I enjoy the most. I think that might be, though, because if I was forced to choose my favourite member of Kiss, I would probably go with Paul. Do you have a favourite member of the band? And pardon the pun, you've got to choose.
I am a Paul Stanley girl through and through. I am Paul Stanley, as far as musical influences go, is probably my biggest musical influence of all time. I love the man. He's amazing. And other than probably for me, other than Paul McCartney, he's probably the most solid rock songwriter, performer, singer ever, hands down for me. He's the guy.
So if we move on to track two, which is Parasite. So Parasite's one of the heavier tracks on the album, written by Ace Frehley, but sang by Gene Simmons, as Ace wasn't confident in his singing voice at that time. And of course, this is an issue that he famously had right up until he sang on Shock Me for Love Gun. With the benefit of hindsight, how do you feel that Ace's voice stands up to the rest of the band? And do you think that he would have done a good job on Parasite?
Obviously, vocally, he's not quite strong. But what saves Ace as a vocalist is that he has character. So I think it was actually a wise choice to give his song, because I don't think it fit his personality, whereas it fits Gene's personality.
And it's funny, readers of ultimateclassicrock.com voted Parasite as their favourite song on Hotter Than Hell, just inching out the title track, Hotter Than Hell. Would you say it's a fan favourite in general with Kiss fans?
Yes, it is, because it's quite heavy and that riff is quite tribal. I went on the Kiss Cruise in 2015 and the Dead Daisies were playing, and they did a version of Parasite. They played on the last night and they played Parasite, and it was just a little more funky, almost a little Latina kind of vibe going on. I was like, I can totally hear that in the song now.
Yeah, so Parasite's been covered by many bands. You were talking about the Dead Daisies there on the Kiss Cruise, most notably by Anthrax in 1994. So hard rock and metal was still a relatively kind of new thing in the mid-70s when Hotter Than Hell was recorded. Surely that awesome riff on Parasite is a precursor to that sort of thrash style that bands like Anthrax and Metallica would like establish in the 80s.
Absolutely, but people don't like to suggest that Kiss was a precursor for that, because they wear makeup and thrash is manly and what have you.
So we'll move on to Going Blind, which is our next track on the album. It's arguably the most controversial track. Written and sung by Gene, the song is about a 93-year-old man who was in love with a 16-year-old girl. So musically and lyrically, it's one of the darkest songs on the album. But it's a great example of this edginess we were talking about that the band had in this early stage in their career that they'd never really kind of replicated for many years after.
It's an odd song. And again, it's kind of, it's a fan favourite because they never really played it. Very odd lyrically, and it's very different for Gene. Obviously, Gene co-wrote this song with Steve Cornell, and people are kind of like pushing it under the rug that he was arrested for certain things. And you actually think about the lyrical content, that's not good. Gene really loved a band called Mountain, and it was very, very Mountain, but it was odd in the sense that it's a ballad, but it's not recorded acoustically, it's all electric. So it makes it sound very different and very unique.
Yeah, absolutely. So the song, as you were kind of touching on, is actually a reworking of a Wicked Lester song. And for those who don't know, Wicked Lester were the band that Gene and Paul were in that evolved into Kiss. Have you heard any of Wicked Lester's stuff, and is it kind of widely available?
Yeah, you can find that stuff on the internet. I mean, I've heard the Wicked Lester album that they recorded that was entirely different to Kiss. It's got flutes, it's got panpipes on it. It was very, very, very different. They were chasing trends with every song. So, oh, this song has panpipes on it, we're going to put it on that. Or this song has flutes, we should totally do that. So Going Blind, when it was recorded by Kiss, becomes this really unique, different thing from the rest of their catalogue. It's one on its own, really.
Yeah, totally. And interestingly, just a fun fact, that it was allegedly Paul Stanley who, during the recording of the song, told Gene to sing the line, "I'm 93, you're 16. Or at least that's what I've read anyway.
I'm not too sure about that. But, you know, it does actually make the song actually a little lyrically disturbing. And again, that adds to the heaviness of the album. It makes it deeper and it makes it darker.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you should touch on that. I think that the song musically complements the desperation felt in the lyrics, and it's, as you've said, it's surely this song is the perfect example to detractors of the band who think that every song is about rock and roll all night and party every day, because this is something very, very different. So that's just the beginning of my chat with Beth Blade about Kiss's somewhat difficult second album, Hotter Than Hell. Coming up in just a little bit, which song did Peter Criss love so much he threatened to leave Kiss if he didn't get to sing it? And how does Ace Frehley's solo on Strange Ways rank up against the great Kiss guitar solos over their career? All that and more right after this.
they'd never done anything like this album before, ever. There was such a mix of stuff on it.
Would you like to get involved with the discussion on My Classic Album, or maybe you'd like to be a guest on a future episode?
I don't think there's any other album that is so poignant and so human in its lyrics.
Like us on Facebook by searching for My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Alternatively, you could follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or even tweet us over at MCA_podcast. And who knows, you could be chatting with me very soon about your classic album.
Now for me, it's the music that gets me with this one. It's just beautifully put together, in my opinion.
Make sure you never miss an episode and keep up to date with all the latest news at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk.
So we'll move on to our next track, which is the title track, Hotter Than Hell. So this is probably one of the most recognisable songs on the album, written and sung by Paul. This one's about desiring a married woman and doing anything to get there. Paul said in the past on several occasions that this song is his tribute to Free's All Right Now, as the song meant a lot to him. How important are Paul's influence, such as Free and the Beatles, like we were talking about earlier, how important are those influences on the sound of Kiss?
Oh, massively so. I mean, as musicians, your influences come out in your hands or in your voice, and that can't be helped sometimes. It's just ingrained in your DNA when you listen to something so much. It gets inside of you and it becomes a part of you. You know, Paul loves the Raspberries. They were big fans of Slade, the Beatles. And it really, you can hear that in their writing, especially in their early stuff. By the time they get to Destroyer, that's how Kiss is. They found themselves. The first three albums, you can really hear the other influences. And it's a story song. It's a very colloquial song. And then you get to the end of the song, and it goes in a completely different direction. And that's what I love about this song.
Yeah, and I guess that was a big part of why I love it as well, that you get to the end of the song and there's this awesome kind of riff. Paul Stanley said of that, "I didn't quite know how to end it, so I came up with this riff that was kind of like a Black Sabbath kind of riff, and we tacked that on." And I think both Paul and Ace are so on form with this kind of Sabbath-esque moment at the end. How important is that musical partnership in these early days between Paul and Ace?
Well, actually, you know, Paul Stanley and Ace Frehley never really co-wrote together. I think in the Kiss catalogue that are actually credited as being written by Paul Stanley and Ace Frehley together, one of them is on this album and the other is on Dressed to Kill, which is Rock Bottom, and the one on this album is Coming Home. They didn't really write together, but they complemented each other perfectly when it came to guitar, because obviously Paul is a rhythm guitarist and Ace is a lead guitarist. They know how to work together, and that end part is just that, when that comes together, is sublime. And Kiss, again, they're tacked as being a three-chord band, besides the fact that this song is a fairly standard rock song, and then on the end they just put a completely different jam and a solo. That's rare in rock and roll, you know. It's not a common structure that people use to write.
Yeah. So Donald A. Guarisco, I believe I pronounced his name correctly there, at allmusic.com, called Hotter Than Hell one of the band's best entries in the metal arena, as well as a gutsy rocker full of pile driver riffs. So we've talked a little bit about kind of Anthrax and that kind of thrash metal development in the 80s, but how important do you think Kiss are in the evolution of heavy metal in general?
Really, really important. I mean, like I said earlier, Kiss were billed as heavy metal masters in New York in 1973 and 1974 because they were just heavier than everybody else. They played louder than everybody else. And isn't that what heavy metal started off as? You know, Sabbath, obviously, I would say, kicked off the trend of that darker material, that darker, heavier sound, the atmosphere of it. At the time, Kiss was absolutely heavy metal. You have to be comparative, because now you get bands that are so heavy, like Gojira and Lamb of God. People don't think of, in 1973, this is what was considered heavy metal. And they tend not to appreciate that a certain number of bands influenced all of that, and without those original core bands, none of it would have happened.
Absolutely. And then just to kind of bring things full circle, when we're talking about Paul and Ace, that they recently played together on Ace's latest album, Origins Volume 1, on a cover of Freeze, Fire and Water. So I think that kind of just brings things really nicely together with what we've been talking about. And there's also a cover of Parasite on there. I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to Ace's latest album.
Yeah, yet. I listened to it. I think what Ace should do is that, I know this is terrible, but I think he should do a Slash, as much as his voice is good on one or two songs. But if Ace got some guest singers on his songs, I think he could make a really incredible record. And rather than just doing covers, do some original material with guest singers. I would absolutely love for Ace to do that.
Totally. So we'll move on to Let Me Go Rock and Roll, which is our next track. Hotter Than Hell, of course, was the B-side to this, which was the only single from the album. And sadly, due to Casablanca's troubles at the time, the single was badly promoted and it didn't chart very well. Out of the 10 tracks on the album, is this the one that you think is kind of the strongest as a lead single? Or was there another track that you maybe would have picked?
Hotter Than Hell, got to choose. Coming Home, even. I think Coming Home is a great pop song. Let Me Go Rock and Roll as a single, and just so you know, if you ever come across an early Let Me Go Rock and Roll 7-inch vinyl, they are worth so much money. They're so rare, you can't get them. There's only 100, 200 in existence. I'm not sure on the figures, but I don't think it should have been the single. No, I think one of the Stanley songs should have been the single, and it's actually really rare that Let Me Go Rock and Roll was released as a single, because when it comes to Kiss albums, I think Gene's only had maybe 3 on all of the Kiss albums. Releasing Let Me Go Rock and Roll as the single was a mistake, I think, but it turned out well in the end for them.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in some ways there may have been a thought that it was a more accessible song than some of the others on the album. Gene's gone on record to say that the song's about romantic excitement. And it almost in some ways sounds like kind of a precursor to, say, like Rock and Roll All Night, for example, that would come on the next album. Ace's solo in particular reminds me of that kind of solo that he would play on the live version of Rock and Roll All Night, if that makes any sense. Do you think this song's a big indicator of the direction that Kiss would take?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love Let Me Go Rock and Roll when it's played live. My favourite version of it is actually on the Kiss Symphony. And the solos are just, they're so melodic and so good, and it's just a party song that makes you want to get up and have a dance. And people kind of rip into bands like that, like AC/DC and Kiss. It's absolutely necessary to rock and roll to have those kind of songs.
Totally, absolutely. So our next track that comes up is All the Way. Now, the Encyclopedia of Kiss calls All the Way one of Gene's more forgettable numbers, but I'm not particularly sure I agree with that one. For me, it feels very much like a Gene. Yeah, it feels very much like feels very much like a Gene song. Yeah, totally. And once again, it's got an awesome Ace solo. I mean, you've started to share already. What are your thoughts on All the Way?
I love All the Way. The riff is so disjointed, but it's also a little groovy at the same time, and it's got that cowbell in it. It plays the riff, and then there's ding. And it's great. And lyrically, again, it's a little bit different for Gene, because usually, he actually goes on to be singing songs about bedding women and what have you. You know what he's like. But All the Way is actually when, around the time when Gene had a steady girlfriend, and it's actually talking about the fact that he's just saying what needs to be said to get this woman to get off his back, which is again a little different than what he usually writes. And it's so catchy. I get this song stuck in my head all the time.
And I guess kind of when you put it next to a track like Going Blind or Watching You that's coming up next, it might be easy for some to dismiss it, but like as we're saying, I don't think that's wise at all. I do think it is a really great track.
Wedged in between other songs that are quite strong. This is how bands get rarity tracks and stuff like that. There's so many songs that people want to hear played. And they started playing it on the Rock the Nation tour, and people were going crazy for it. And again, there's actually a big influence from one song on Kiss, Mississippi Queen by Mountain. And there's actually a band who's a friend of ours, Mason Hill, and we were doing a show up in Scotland with them and Marco Mendoza, and the cover that they played was Mississippi Queen. And at first I was like, hang on, is that a Kiss song? No, it's not. It's Mississippi Queen. It's so ingrained in Kiss, that song, that it's an, you know, Gene quotes it as an influence for at least, I think, 3 songs on this album alone are influenced by that song. All the Way is like a diamond in the rough.
Yeah. And it's funny you should be talking about Mississippi Queen, because one of the other songs that Gene has said is kind of inspired by that song is Watching You, which is kind of up next. So this is the 4th song written by Gene on the album and the 5th sung by him. He's easily the most recognisable member of Kiss within popular culture for people who maybe aren't familiar with the band. For those who possibly aren't as big Kiss fans as we are, how important is Gene Simmons to the overall image and the music of Kiss?
He is so important. The original 4 people in Kiss are all as equally important to the band. The place where Gene really shines is the fact that he had determination and a hard work ethic. But also, I think he's a criminally underrated bass player. He's a brilliant songwriter. And I mean, if you listen to Watching You, that riff is one of the best riffs I have ever heard, ever. Again, it doesn't get his due. So Gene actually plays guitar as well as bass. And he was really necessary to the image, you know, because he internalized what happened to him in his childhood and brought it to life on stage. And he really was a monster on stage. If you look at those early videos of him, he is so in character. He is so focused on the fact that he's not Gene Simmons in those early days when he's playing. He's the demon. He's that character. And that kind of focus and that kind of commitment is why Gene is who he is.
Yeah, totally, absolutely. So, bearing in mind that Gene also wrote Going Blind and later tracks like such as like Christine 16, is Gene the guy who's more likely to write kind of more darker, different stuff than the rest of the band?
Yeah, I would say so. He has a fairly eclectic writing style. You get everything from a Beatles ballad to a heavy metal number, and that really adds to the whole of Kiss in quite a important way. It just gives it that little bit of an edge.
Yeah, and just kind of while we're kind of touching on Gene at the moment, and I just think that Watching You is kind of a really good example of kind of why Gene's so important to the band. Just kind of a tidbit for yourself and anyone who's listening, that me and my wife got married a couple of years ago, and the last song that we had at the very end of our wedding, so I obviously love Kiss and rock music, my wife loves Disney, and the last song that we had before everybody went home was Gene's version of When You Wish Upon a Star off his solo album. So just a little tidbit there for you.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's really sweet. You know, Gene gets a bad rap from people who don't know anything about him or his background, and he gets himself in all sorts of trouble all the time for saying what people deem the wrong thing. But when you come as an immigrant boy from poverty, moving to America, your mother has been in the concentration camps of Germany and managed to survive, and you're in this new land and you don't speak the language, and you see the movies for the first time. And Gene has come from being that little boy in a disadvantaged situation to being a multi-millionaire rock star, and that is the American dream. It really is. And he gets a bad rap for being successful, and I think it's a real shame, because if you actually dig deeper with Gene, he's a very kind man. He's very charitable. He looks after a lot of people, and you know, he's lived and made his dream happen, and I think he really deserves, you know, to be congratulated for that, because it's pretty hard slog when you actually read about it. And he's just come out and he's an icon. He's an icon at the end of the day. And him as a little boy watching those Disney movies, Pinocchio, what have you, probably could never imagine that he is where he is now. And that's beautiful.
Absolutely. Just before we move on, just the way you were talking there about kind of how kind Gene is, it just made me think of kind of one more thing, that when I was listening to Chris Jericho's podcast, Talk Is Jericho, and he'd interviewed Gene Simmons on an episode a year or two ago, And he'd said that after the interview had finished, that Gene had said, "Do you have any kids?" And Jericho had said, "Oh, yeah, I've got a couple of daughters." And he'd said, "Right, come with me." And took him into the room, the infamous room full of Kiss merchandise, and said, "Right, they can each have one of these. And gave Jericho these like massive goodie bags just full of Kiss merchandise, which he didn't have to do, you know what I mean?
I mean, I've met Gene a couple of times, and every time I've met any of the guys in Kiss or anybody involved in the Kiss world, they are extremely kind. They're genuinely good people. Gene goes out of his way a lot to make people laugh. He's a bit of a clown. And there's an interview, and I'll send it to you afterwards if I can find it, that he did in Australia, where it actually delves into the charity work that he does, and he supports a lot of kids in Africa, puts them through school, etc. And he starts tearing up when he's talking about when kids come to Kiss concerts and he sees them out there with their little horns in the air. He gets choked up.
So we'll move on to our next track on the album, which is Mainline. So this is the first of two tracks on the album sang by Peter Criss. And a lot has been said about Peter's vocal abilities over the year. We touched on Ace earlier, but, you know, Peter obviously gets called the Ringo of the band for reasons other than he's the drummer. Do you think he gets a bad rap, or do you agree that perhaps his singing isn't the best?
When he's going nuts, he's got that really bluesy, salt and pepper, gravelly voice. And again, it just adds a complete other dimension to the band that they wouldn't have had if he hadn't been the original drummer. I think he gets a lot of stick because he was a street kid, and he was a self-taught musician, you know, didn't have any lessons in drumming or singing. What he learned from just doing it. But when Peter Criss sings, and he's, you know, I love his voice, I really do.
So Mainline was actually written by Paul Stanley, who shared the story of how Peter came to be the one who sang vocals on the track. So he said, "Mainline is a cool rock and roll song. Peter said to Gene and I, if I don't sing this song, I'll quit the band. If it means that much to you, fine, sing the song. I didn't write the song for someone else, I wrote the song for me. I'd rather somebody said to me, this means a lot to me, than to start holding things over my head." Do you think this is kind of the start of some of these kind of documented troubles that the band would have with Peter over the following years?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, Peter had problems from the beginning of joining the band. I think it was almost his desperation to succeed, to be a success, that was almost his downfall. And he, you know, very famously, even with Black Diamond, he wanted to sing that song and was like, "I'll quit the band if I can't sing this song," because, you know, and it's that kind of attitude that in a lot of bands in general causes problems when somebody threatens to quit over trivial things rather than actually just being honest with the other band members. Obviously, Peter had some problems with partying and drinking and drugs later on. And it's probably from that inability to communicate with the rest of the band why it got so bad and why he eventually left. I absolutely love Mainline. I think it's a great song. Again, it's another one that people don't really know in the Kiss catalogue, but it's really, you know, groovy, and it's got a little bit of a beat to it. So I just wanted to say, give a little bit of love to Mainline.
Absolutely, yeah. So Coming Home is our next track, and it's perhaps the best example of the band's experiences in California being reflected on the album. So Paul, who wrote the song with Ace, said of the track, "We were stuck at a terrible hotel where we had these real little rooms and we were all homesick. I really missed New York." So we've talked in the past on My Classic Album about how being away from home can affect musicians in different ways, be it kind of a yearning to go back home or a love for the place you've travelled to. How do you personally find life when you're on the road as opposed to when you have the opportunity to be home?
I get really bad wanderlust. I'm a traveler, and I like moving around quite a lot. I like going to different places. When we're out gigging, sometimes I'll get, you know, lyrical idea or a riff and I'll record it on my phone. But the place where I write most is at home, sat on the end of my bed, like I always have done. And that sense of home with a musician, it can make you feel comfortable. So I think that sometimes going somewhere else and being forced to write can actually make you grow.
Yeah, absolutely. So Robert Duncan says of Coming Home, "One wonders if the homesick lyrics to Coming Home actually portray the aforementioned homesickness, or are just another song about the road. I prefer to think the former, though it should be noticed that this is the first Kiss song that is at least partially about touring in a band. Do you think this is kind of the... Would they revisit this theme of being away from home more? I guess to a lesser extent, you could argue Beth from Destroyer kind of ties in with the sort of same theme.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm trying to think off the top of my head. Coming home. I don't think there's many songs that are along the same theme of missing home. There's an album on Dressed to Kill. There's a song called Room Service, which I think is a great song, that is about staying in hotels and all that kind of thing. But other than that, I can't really think of anything it's quite unique. And it's another thing that makes this album so interesting is that each song kind of touches on a different topic almost, and it gives it real complexity.
Yeah, totally. So our final track is Strange Ways. So Strange Ways was written by Ace and was Peter's second song on vocals for Hotter Than Hell. The big talking point on Strange Ways, however, is the absolutely phenomenal solo from Ace. So I've highlighted Ace's solos throughout our chat. While Kiss have had their share of amazing guitarists over the years, what do you think that Ace brings to Kiss that maybe other guitarists haven't been able to emulate?
So the thing about Ace is that Ace is a one-off. There's nobody who plays like him. He's really melodic in his playing, and the way that I like to see it is that if I was writing a solo, I can sing along to it. So it's a song within a song. And you can see all the different sections, what he's done, why he's decided to go where he's gone. And you can hum it in your head. It's a separate melody inside the song. And Ace does that really, really, really well. If you look at a song like Detroit Rock City, the original solo on the original demo is more Ace than the solo that came out, because Bob Ezrin was like, Ace, you don't have to overplay for this song. Play something melodic. And Bob Ezrin was showing him some ideas on the piano. And you get that solo that is so simple, but everybody can remember it. And that's why Ace is one of those guitar players who influenced a whole other generation of guitar players.
He may not be the most polished, but he's got this really unique and influential style. Where would that solo from Strange Ways rank for you amongst kind of Ace's solos or just Kiss guitar solos in general throughout their career?
That solo is spectacular. So he did it in one take, using a Big Muff pedal and the natural feedback from the amplifier, and it was perfect. It's one of those solos that literally it makes me feel electric. I'm just like, I get lost in it. It's so good. It's not my favorite Ace solo, but it's definitely, definitely up there. And Strange Ways as a song, again, in the Kiss catalogue, I would actually say that it's probably the first grunge song ever recorded. Because to me, it's a grunge song. And, you know, if you do your research, I can't really find anything that comes before it that I would call grunge.
And it's funny because, I mean, of course, Nirvana, you know, did cite Kiss as an influence in some ways. You know, they played on kind of Kiss tribute albums before they made it big. So I guess it would make sense that, you know, the band that everyone defines with grunge would find something in Kiss's music that they could relate to.
Absolutely. I mean, Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam, loads of those guys are big Kiss fans as well. So again, it takes back to the fact that you were saying Kiss were a heavy metal band at the time, but now they're seen as almost a cock rock band. In the early days, they were quite heavy, and that influence isn't really touched upon in the general media. So there's actually a story of Strange Ways where Peter wanted to include a 9-minute drum solo in this song. And it was another case of, if you don't let me do this drum solo, I'm going to quit. So they recorded it and then they just left it out. Gene and Paul made the decision to leave it out and just send that album to print. I think it's a great finisher because it's different, and then it just ends on that chord, da-da-da. And you can still hear the cymbals fizzing slightly, and it's a very sudden end. It's very dramatic. It's not the best album ender that they've ever had, but I think it's probably the most unique.
So I think in spite of what people have said about its production, and we've talked about that a lot, I think we've proved why Hotter Than Hell is a great Kiss album, a great rock album, and one that's very important in the band's history. Why do you think it stood the test of time?
Again, I think it stood the test of time because the songs are very well written and each one is unique to the other, I mean, you have Strange Ways, you've got Coming Home, which is about being homesick. You've got Mainline, which is, well, you know what that one's about. Watching You is almost, you know, it's actually inspired by the movie Rear Window, by Alfred Hitchcock movie. So it's about stalking. All the Way is about a girl talking to you and you wanting to shut her up. Let Me Go Rock and Roll is just a great rock song. Hotter Than Hell is a story song and it flows really nicely. And it just gives some contrast and it gives it a little bit more depth.
So finally, and this is the question I ask everyone on My Classic Album, why is Hotter Than Hell your classic album and why should people check it out?
It's my classic album because I'm a very, when I write songs, I'm a very riff-orientated person. And when you listen to the riffs on Hotter Than Hell, some of them are just absolutely outstanding and they don't get the credit that they deserve for. Because I am so influenced by it. This music is inside of me and I couldn't not be influenced by it if I tried. And people should check it out because as far as people have their preconceived notions about Kiss and what they're going to be like, this album has changed some people's minds.
Well, Beth, thank you very much for taking the time out to chat with me today. It's been absolutely awesome. And yeah.
Hi, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah. And hopefully we'll have you back someday talking about, well, another Kiss album or whatever you want.
Ooh, don't make me choose.
A huge thanks to Beth Blade for taking time out to chat about Kiss's second album and a classic album at that. Hotter Than Hell. You know, it's really fun to chat to anyone about their favourite album, but when it's by a band that you've loved for a long time in the way that I've loved Kiss, it was just really cool to kind of chat to someone who has that kind of feelings about the band too. So Beth is the lead singer of Beth Blade and the Beautiful Disasters, who are an awesome hard rock band from Cardiff. Their debut album, Bad Habit, is out now on CD and download. Classic Rock magazine gave the album an awesome review on release. Taking a leaf out of the Joan Jett, Lita Ford School of Chick Rock, Cardiff-based Beth Blade and the Beautiful Disasters have done their homework. Powerplay magazine say that Beth Blade and the Beautiful Disasters come across like a cross between Hailstorm and Joan Jett, but there's also a major hint of Jodie Turner in the way Beth can turn from angel to psycho bitch in a heartbeat. And finally, Moshville Times wrote there are plenty of hard rock bands out there, so it continues to surprise me when I pop a new one on for review and it blows me away. Albums like Bad Habit prove that rock and roll simply cannot die. I've listened to the album myself. It is absolutely awesome. Right down my street. For more information about Beth Blade and the Beautiful Disasters, including information about their upcoming UK tour with Swedish rockers Electric Boys, get yourself over to BethBladeandTheBeautifulDisasters.com. Right, and I guess that is it. That's the end of this episode of My Classic Album, which is almost a shame. I've really enjoyed myself, but I know the next month's episode is going to be just as awesome. So next month's episode of My Classic Album will be looking, as I said earlier, at Carole King's Tapestry, and Ashton Lane singer Esther O'Connor has chosen the album and will join me to chat about a real heavyweight in terms of classic albums, is Tapestry. And then, of course, in August, it'll be a year of My Classic Album, and I'll be sitting down with Ian Matthews, and we'll be looking at that back catalogue of Queen. In the meantime, if you have any thoughts particularly on the discography episode, if you have a favourite Queen album or you have a track that you feel is really underappreciated, get yourself on our social media pages. Get to Facebook, My Classic Album with Mike Norris, My Classic Album Podcast on Instagram, or at @MCA_podcast on Twitter, and just let me know your favourite Queen album. I think I'd find that really interesting. Obviously, I know my favourite, but I would like to know what Queen albums you guys enjoy. And if you need any more of that information, just get yourself over to www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. And until July, have a great month. Cheers.